Hello and welcome to this week's Inside Education. Our website is insideed.com, where you can listen to or download podcasts of all previous Inside Education programmes. I'm Sean Delaney and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes or so. On last week's programme, I brought you my first set of interviews from the Computers and Education Society of Ireland, or CESI, Annual Conference 2013. This week, I have some more conference speakers for you to meet. Later on, we'll hear how one US mathematics teacher decides on how he'll use technology in his classroom. We'll also hear about how technology can help you to relax. But first, we'll find out why the participation of girls and women in technology classes lags behind that of boys and men, and about online learning. Catherine Cronin is the Academic Coordinator of Online IT Programmes and a Lecturer in Information Technology at the National University of Ireland, Galway, NUIG. Her work focuses on online and open education, digital literacies and social media in education. She also works on supporting and connecting women in science, technology, engineering and mathematics. That's where our conversation began, with Catherine telling me why it's necessary to think about how to get girls and women more interested in technology.
There are a number of reasons. One is, for example, at the moment, out of all the undergraduate students who are studying IT and computer science in Ireland, only 15% of those are women. It's a very low percentage, and it's been persistently low for many years. And the proportion of women in other courses, such as things like engineering and physics, would be similar. So, first of all, there are talented, able girls who are not making those choices, and we wonder why that is, because certainly they would, many of them might make wonderful engineers or computer scientists or software engineers or physicists. But the other reason is that research shows that diverse groups actually work much better. They collaborate better. They're less susceptible to groupthink and things like that. And we know the perils of that, you know, over the last few years. So groups that are diverse in terms of gender and many other things will not only work better together, it'll be a more enjoyable place to work, but they'll create better solutions to the problems that we have and create better technology.
And why do you think girls and women are so underrepresented in these kind of programs that you're talking about? And when does that start?
Well, see, that is such an interesting question. You know, there's an awful lot of research that's been done about this over the last 30 years or so. So one area that people really focus on is the gendering that goes on, just the social process of gendering, which starts the moment children are born. We color code them virtually, pink and blue. We buy different toys for them. We encourage them into different activities. So, you know, as I said, much research has shown that the types of toys and activities and behaviors that we encourage in boys would predispose them more towards subjects like science and technology.
Are we talking about toys like Lego and Meccano are more likely to be given to boys, and maybe girls are more likely to get dolls or dolls' houses, things like that?
That's exactly right. Yes, yes. The other side of the coin that I should mention, apart from the, you know, the social process of gendering that goes on in terms of individuals, is that research also shows that the actual fields of science and technology themselves are gendered. So because of their history and practitioners over many years, the science and technology actually has become a masculine culture. And this is so even in schools, where if there's a computer lab, it might not be a place where girls might want to go. Perhaps most of the teachers are male. Most of the people who use that particular lab are male. So this happens, you know, starting very young. So schools very much have a role in challenging that. You know, and there are many ways that we can challenge that. And if we don't, if we're not aware of it, maybe we're not as likely to challenge it. We just fall into, you know, the old patterns.
If we take primary school level first, what can primary teachers do to encourage girls to be more likely to get involved in technology?
Well, I suppose, first of all, being aware that perhaps the girls might not be likely to make those choices. So one thing is focusing less on kind of, as I say, the robots, rockets and racing cars, which are often the examples, you know, that are used in technology classrooms, and things like social applications of technology, how technology can be used and science can be used to increase the quality of life. What are the applications in our own community? You know, where it's used. So focusing more on the holistic applications of technology rather than, as I said, the age-old examples that we sometimes fall into.
And if we go on then to older children and teenagers, what can post-primary schools do to promote girls and women to be interested in technology?
Well, you know, there are many things. Some of the things I already mentioned, just about being aware of the fact that the spaces that we teach computing and technological subjects in may be gendered. So if there are just a few girls, we'll say, in a physics class or in a technical graphics class, applied maths, being aware of that and using, as I said, examples that are not just, you know, masculine examples, or if you invite speakers in, not just having, you know, the easy option of the local engineer who might be a male, for example. So being aware of the interesting social history of technology, it isn't just male engineers who we can call. We can talk about people like Ada Lovelace, the first programmer. So there's a very, very interesting social history and political history of technology. So presenting technology in that wider context. And by the way, this is also shown to be very interesting for boys as well. It isn't just girls that are interested by this. The other thing is just the methods that we use in our teaching. So things that include things like collaboration, group work, debating, as opposed to simply didactic teaching methods. These are all things that would appeal to girls and to boys, and to broaden the scope.
And then what about third level? When it comes to choosing courses at third level, what can higher education institutions do to promote interest in technology among girls and women?
Well, again, I mean, it's how we teach, the methods that we use to teach, being aware of all these kinds of things that I've mentioned. I'll give you one small example. In computer science and IT, where I teach at the National University of Ireland in Galway, you might have a class where there are 5 girls out of a class of, say, 50. Now, if you are dividing that class up into teams of 3 or 4 for group work, if you do that randomly, you may have 5 different groups with one female student in each one. So this is an example where equity of treatment is not equal equity of opportunity. So why not, when you're creating the groups, have a pair of girls or 3 girls in a group with, you know, so it'd be mixed girls and lads. Because if you have a group of 4 with, you know, one female student in the group, when it comes time to record the notes for the meeting or someone, they'll say, Asher, why don't you do that? So, you know, those female students will be isolated. So again, it's more about awareness. So we need to do things for students, but we need to raise awareness of, you know, the educators, primary, secondary and third level, so that they will think about those things, you know, when they're teaching.
The other area of interest that you have, Catherine, is in open and online education, which you're working on at, as you said, NUI Galway. What does that work involve?
Well, we offer a couple of online programs, a master's degree and a postgraduate diploma in software engineering at NUI Galway. We've been running those since 2004. So we're very active in online and blended learning at the university. But in the last year or two, open learning has, you know, become the new revolution of people making their educational resources available online and for free. So NUI Galway is exploring ways that we might be able to offer some of what we do now in closed online spaces, in open spaces, which is be a great asset for our current students, future students and the community.
The big challenge there, of course, though, is how will the university fund itself if it's going to make its courses, which is the one thing it has, if it's going to make them available free?
Yes, well, this is the question, and this is the source of many, many wonderful conversations that are going on at the moment, not just at NUI Galway, I add. The leaders now, Stanford University, many other universities in the States and in Europe, are showing that actually making education available openly can be positive for both the university, as I said, and for students, and for people who may not be able to access third level education. The funding models have yet to be determined about how this is going to work out long term. But I think that, you know, my own university, NUI Galway, should very much be active in that space, because we're learning very much, you know, by trying this, you know, by piloting initiatives like this. And I think we need to do that.
And what kind of things are you learning about open education?
Well, for example, I would consider myself and call myself an open educator. And I liaise with people not just in my department and my university, but with other educators all over the world. And since I've been doing that for the past 4 years or so, I've become a far better educator. My students have access to people all over the world, where, for example, my second year IT students now, we're liaising with students in the UK, Barcelona, Berlin and Auckland, New Zealand, by using Twitter, live video, commenting on one another's work. So that is the future of education. You know, these are the environments that our students are going to work in. So we need to construct those kinds of experiences for students while they're students, so they can develop some of those skills.
And the other area then is online learning. What works in online learning and what doesn't work?
Well, the pedagogy comes before the technology, as everybody loves to say. You know, the same things work online as work offline. So it's an important it's an important idea in every online course to develop community. And that's one of the first things that our online facilitators do. So whether you're using online discussion forums or synchronous video or, you know, asynchronous forums, our facilitators are all technically adept, but also very good at creating online communities so that people feel that they're part of a group and can provide feedback to one another and, you know, get the kinds of, you know, nice feeling that they're in a group of fellow learners as you would in a classroom setting.
And that was Catherine Cronin from NUI Galway. You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Podcasts of previous programmes can be downloaded from iTunes or from our website insideed.com. The next person I spoke to at the SESI conference was one of the keynote speakers, Dan Meyer. Dan Meyer taught high school maths in the United States for 6 years, and he is currently studying how to teach maths at Stanford University. He's appeared on CNN and Good Morning America, and his TED talk, Math Class Needs a Makeover, has been viewed over 1 million times. He gave the capstone keynote address at the 2013 SESI conference. When I spoke to him before his presentation, he told me what his presentation at the conference would be about.
Yeah, sure. So today I just got out of a session just now on 40 technology tools for the classroom, which was a great session, lots of interesting things. But I find at tech sessions, we're often just inundated with lots of different tools we could use at any point. So my session today will explain my EdTech manifesto, my rationale for which tools I pick up, which ones I discard, the reasons why I would use or not use a given tool.
And can you tell us a little bit about that manifesto and what tools you would use, or how can teachers decide whether or not to use particular tools?
Yeah, this is a personal manifesto. Other people have different ones that are valuable, of course, and there's tools that fall outside of it, email, productivity tools, that sort of thing. But largely, I'm looking for tools that help me do one of three things, either capture perplexity, share perplexity, or resolve perplexity with students. And perplexity is just that state of having a question in your head that is burning and prominent, and you want to get an answer for it. And if I can get a student in that state, that's a productive moment for instruction. So the tools I want are ones that help me capture perplexing moments, share them with students, and then resolve them with students.
So can you give us an example of what would be a moment of perplexity?
Yeah, I mean, for instance, a student is watching a video of a swimming pool filling up with a small hose, and that pool just fills up slowly, slowly, slowly. And the student and the person watching the pool filling up can't help but wonder, how long will this take to fill up? And can I leave for an hour and go make myself a sandwich or something? So the video in that case, the tools that captured the video, the tools that shared the video, those are tools that help satisfy my EdTech manifesto.
The three stages again are
capturing, sharing, and resolving, all very distinct. I can capture perplexity using my camera, but then I've got to share it somehow with students, which requires a projector of some sort or some laptop. And then resolving perplexity is generally about the mathematical tools in my case. The math is the technology that helps students answer their question. For instance, volume of solids would be how students would answer their own question of how long will this pool take to fill up? That is the technology. My phone is probably the most valuable piece of technology I have in terms of capturing perplexity, in that it lets me take photos. I'll be driving down a road somewhere and I'll notice something like in the California forest, there's a tree that's been chopped down and all of its rings are spreading on to eternity. I can't help but wonder, how old is this tree? So I take a photo of that. So, or a video for other events, or I take notes on questions that I have. So in that sense, this one device is the most valuable for me for capturing perplexity. There's others, of course, but there's a lot of tools that just fall outside of that definition that other teachers are very enthusiastic about. And that's fine. I think that everyone needs to have a very critical manifesto of their own for choosing or rejecting a certain tool. Our resources are just too finite to uncritically attend sessions like 40 great tools for the classroom. We don't have the days, the money, or the patience to do all of them.
And if you were to take the sharing perplexity, then would you be talking about the same piece of technology, or would you could that be a different piece of technology that you would use?
Yeah, often different. So for sharing perplexity, certainly having a laptop to store these perplexing photos and videos and other resources is essential. Having a projector to display these resources is essential. The projector basically punches a hole in the wall of my classroom to the outside world. There's other tools that are so great, like video editing tools help me chop up a certain video in a way that enhances the perplexing moment, that makes the question more prominent, more enticing. So I use tools like video editing or photo editing quite a lot.
And the third step then is the resolving perplexity. How might that arise?
Yeah, that's generally the actual content or skill or practice that we would like students to learn. So I call it technology rather loosely. So, I mean, for instance, the volume of 3D solids would be how you'd resolve the question, how long will it take this pool to fill up? If I'm curious about a foot race that I'm involved in and I want to know if I'll beat my friend, we're looking at solving simultaneous linear equations. The difference here is that, whereas a lot of times as a new teacher, I'd come into class and say, today, kids, we're going to learn how to solve simultaneous linear equations. Now I capture some video and I share it with students, and they have this question in their heads now, like, wow, who's going to win that? And then they're perplexed. And so the resolution of that perplexity is now that same skill that I would have led with years ago.
So if you were to bring us into one of your maths lessons where there is some use of technology, could you give us an idea of what it might look like?
Yeah, generally speaking, this doesn't happen every day, but oftentimes I'll just open with something from the world itself that I've captured or someone's shared with me, something that'll provoke a question. And then I'll ask students questions like, I'll ask them to guess the answer. Guessing is a very engaging thing for students and doesn't happen very often in math classes. I'll ask them what information they need to know to solve that question, which is also engaging. And then as we get into how we answer this, that might involve an explanation from me. That might involve using tools in math class like GeoGebra or Sketchpad or a calculator, tools that help us answer our questions. And then at the end of that, it's so valuable for students to see the answer. So if they've done all this work and said, well, Mr. Meyer, he beats his friend in that foot race, they're going to want to see the end of that foot race to see if maths really worked. So that's important also.
Okay. And can you say a little bit about GeoGebra and how you use that?
Yeah, GeoGebra is, a tool that I like to use. There's other uses for it, certainly, but I like to use it as a way for students to answer perplexing questions they have. You could use it for general exploration, just open-ended exploration, which is a great use for it. My preferred use is when students have a question and they use it to help get them out of that question, to answer it. So, the path of a basketball is a parabola. I might show students a video that's cut halfway and they wonder, will the basketball that this guy shot go into the hoop? And then I'll send them into GeoGebra and they can play with the parameters of a parabola, this mathematical shape, and they'll move it up and down and widen it and narrow it. In that way, they'll trace the path of the basketball and get an answer. So that'd be how I'd use GeoGebra sometimes.
You're a very prolific blogger, Dan. How would you describe your own blog?
It's a place where I share the things that perplex and interest me with other teachers. So there's that moment where I share it with students in the classroom, but also sharing with teachers had so many benefits have come from that. So many really interesting opportunities. But the best for me is that veteran teachers, older teachers, experienced teachers come alongside me and say, this is an interesting lesson. You should try this, this, or this, or I would change that. And for a while that was painful to hear. You know, I want to believe that all my stuff is this beautiful diamond and perfect in every way. But as I opened myself to that kind of criticism, I became such a better teacher. It was a way of working out my flaws, working out the problems I had and the misapprehensions I had about teaching in real time with people who knew. I often say, I have no evidence for this whatsoever, but I feel like my blog helped me grow 2 years as a teacher for every 1 year I was in the classroom. The professional development was just that good for me.
That was one of the things that amazed me about your blog, is the amount of interactivity or the amount of responses you got to blog entries. How did you build up such a following and build up such a level of interactivity?
Yeah, I mean, you can have a very well-read, popular blog with low interaction, but I've always been very proud of the crowd that I've pulled around me, this this network, and I think that they know that I'm very grateful for their presence there, number one. I demonstrate my gratitude by doing things like if someone leaves a good comment or a productive comment or a productive criticism, I won't, you know, just let that sit there dormant. I'll go into the comments and say, you know, thanks for that. And I'll go one further and I'll copy and paste that comment and the person who left it into the main post that they were commenting on, kind of elevating them. And so there's ways, just as though it were a classroom, where I can add incentives for people to do these things and to help me out. And over time, it really is just the same as any other kind of community building, which good teachers are all very effective at. The same things that you do in a classroom to develop community, try those out on a blog and watch the community develop there.
Because it also sounds like it's acting as very good professional development for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's such a benefit, again, to have people who know more than me come by and donate time to tell me what they know.
How do you go about working on the blog?
It's a place for me to store ideas in half form for a little bit. So I'll just have some random idea for a blog post. I'll save it as a draft. I have thousands of drafts right now, mostly just random detritus. It's just no good. But it's a place where I can. It's an output for my curiosity and perplexity and creativity. So it keeps things moving in and out of my mind. And then eventually I'll just take one and I'll start to polish it and write about it, research it a little bit, then post it for commentary, or if it's a resource, just to share it.
And when do you decide that, yeah, this piece now is ready for publishing?
They're never ready. It's never ready. I just get sick of editing it, of course, is the answer to that question.
You became a maths teacher back in 2004, is that right?
That's right, yes.
So why did you become a teacher?
My father was a teacher. I swore I'd never become a teacher. I saw he was frustrated in some ways with the job. He eventually grew to love it, but I didn't want that life. And then I got into a classroom. I was pushed into a classroom for 3 hours a week as an intern sort of level thing for my college. And it was a really great group of students, just very high performing, very socially just an awesome group, totally unrepresentative of the sort of students I would eventually come to teach. But I loved the experience. I felt like I was of some use there. And that's a very powerful kind of narcotic, to feel like you are useful to a really great group. And that kind of pushed me onwards. And once I got in, I stuck with it, I think, because the challenge was so fun. And so the challenge of good teaching is just never ending. A lot of my friends got into jobs that are well-paying and interesting to them, but they kind of peak early and the challenge is gone. I like that about teaching. You can never stop getting better at it.
What lessons did you learn from teaching?
In terms of what?
In terms of what did you learn that helped you become a better teacher over the years? And what did you learn about life from teaching?
Yeah, I mean, the second question, I think, is just really provocative for me. I started teaching very young, and I was homeschooled up until high school, which socially, I just wasn't ready to have, command, so to speak, or to be in an authoritative role over people that were 3 years, 4 years younger than me. So teaching certainly helped me grow as an individual, become more confident, more secure, less bothered by small petty offenses to my, or criticisms from students. I'll always be grateful for teaching for that. And lessons as a teacher, I guess, trying not to maintain that iron fist of control as kind of this as this shield against any kind of student misbehavior. For my first years, I was always so terrified that students would find me out and they would revolt. I mean, there's 30 of them. There's one of me. But letting go of that and seeing the positive returns of giving some ownership of the class to the students inside of it was such a fun lesson that had dividends all throughout my life.
And an important lesson it was to learn too. That was Dan Meyer there from Stanford University, who gave the capstone keynote address at the 2013 SESI conference. Finally, I spoke to a principal from Carlo, who introduced participants at the conference to a way to manage their stress.
I gave it on the area of stress tolerance. Emotional intelligence has 15 skills within it that you can have strengths or areas need to develop. One of them is stress tolerance. And it's an area, myself, I would see, I suppose, when you're in a principal job, and not just a principal position, but also as teaching. And then you see it within the children as well. They need help with how to deal with stress or anger and things like that. So I was looking at an app called Breathe to Relax. And deep breathing or belly breathing is something that is highly recommended in terms of research for helping deal with stress. So I was just introducing the crowd to a bit of deep breathing.
That seems totally out of place at a technology conference.
Yeah, they all did it as well. They're very diligent. It's kind of funny. No, but the app, you see, I use the app as well. I was saying how technology can help you deal with stress. So I kind of done a lot of research looking at apps that can help us deal with stress. And then there were so many, I just said I'm going to focus on one and kind of do it properly. So I use the technology to demonstrate how to breathe properly, and the technology will help you do that. It also helps you rate your stress levels before and after, and then you can graph them over time, so you should see your stress levels going down.
And what's the name of the app?
It's called Breathe to Relax. Yeah, and it was created by the defense centers in America, so for army veterans and soldiers who had to deal with post-traumatic stress. So it's a pretty serious app as well, so it's you know, if it's advocated by a medical center for research, it has to be good.
How did you get interested yourself in the whole area of technology in education?
I suppose I had no choice, because I'm married to kind of a tech nerd. He's Simon Lewis, and our house is very much like that. And that's all we talk about. And I taught with him for a few years, so I'm kind of going to conferences with him. So I kind of got into it that way. You kind of had to, otherwise I'd be left out of the loop. So that's how I got into it. And then I've been to SESI for the last 6 years.
And what are your own favourite tech applications for education?
Oh, God. I have so many. God, I couldn't pick one. I suppose focusing on the area of stress or creative writing, I use a lot of journaling. So journaling apps for children to be able to express their thoughts and emotions and feelings and stuff like that. So kind of open apps that children can put their own ideas and thoughts into.
Any particular one come to mind?
It is called Day One. I think it's called Day One. You have to pay for it. I think it's a couple of dollars. It's a journal app. It is quite cool because you can use pictures, you can use websites, and you just journal how you're feeling, what you're feeling. And then over time, then you can see them all and they can all profile up. It's quite cool. It keeps everything together. So that's a pretty cool app.
You've been coming to the SESI conference now, as you said, for 6 years. Why do you keep coming back, apart from the fact that you're accompanying your husband, Simon Lewis?
Yeah, I'd come even if Simon wasn't coming at this stage. I come because of all the ideas. And as someone said it today, was it Anne Looney, said the reason people come to SESI is because it's a place where there's no cynicism, there's no negativity. Sometimes when you go to courses, it's very much, oh yeah, it's easy. It's all well and good saying that. But when you get into the class, you know, giving out about pay, giving out. But whereas here, it's actually, no, we want to improve learning, and everyone's in it together 100%. So that's why I come, because there's a great buzz and it keeps you in a great mood and keeps you up to date with what's going on in the classroom.
High praise indeed there for the benefits of the SESI conference from Roz Lewis, who is a school principal from County Carlow. Well, that's it for this week's Inside Education. You can listen to podcasts of previous programmes on InsideEd.com or on iTunes. You can email me at insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Thanks to all my guests on the programme this week and to the organising committee of SESI 2013, especially to Anne McMorrow and John Heffernan. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.